Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day, and him, Kieran Maguire, football finance expert from Liverpool University. And Kieran, we're millionaires.
We are indeed, yes. Producer Guy sent out a message to us on Friday night that we've had 1 million downloads, which is probably, between me and you, 1 million more than we anticipated when we started this nonsense.
Yes, and thank you to everybody who's listened. That will be the strangely absent producer guy this weekend. There hasn't been a word, there hasn't been a peep from him. We're flying blind with this pod. He's in the Bahamas. So, yeah, it's also just occurred to me, Kieran, that we are the best free publicity Liverpool University could ask for.
Yes. They don't seem to think so. I think they're terrified of what I'm going to say next. But
I like to think that their admissions requests are through the roof because of all these young people going, I'm going to go to Liverpool University, where it seems to be a place where things happen.
Well, we do genuinely get now applications from people on the back of what they've heard on this show.
So it
is getting out there.
No, oh, good. Okay, Kieran, it's questions day, but we have two big news stories that I would like to discuss first, one global and one less so. This came out of the blue and slightly under the radar as well, but the Premier League has terminated its biggest overseas TV deal, which is worth more than £500 million over 3 years with immediate effect.
Yes, this is with the Chinese company, PPTV. And they've cited that it's financial rather than political reasons. They were unhappy with the return to football in front of empty stadiums. The timetable was disrupted. I think they were looking for a bit more assistance from the Premier League, according to sources there. But my view is they probably overpaid in the first place. As you rightly said, this is the biggest deal. The parent company of PPTV is a big Chinese conglomerate called Suning, and it's got revenues of £30 billion a year. So, £500 million over 3 years, that's a good night out, as we both know. But at the same time, it's certainly something they could afford. But there does appear to be a change in the attitude of Chinese investors towards football in Europe. We've seen Tony Gide put out of Villa. Yeah. Clearly, the shenanigans at Wigan, which we'll come to shortly, they were involved with Northampton. They pulled out. They presently own Southampton, but the owners there are saying they're open to investment. So, something strange is going to happen. But this is going to cost clubs around about £9 million a season each. Wow. Unless they can plug that particular gap with a new broadcaster in China.
It's hard to separate the politics from the business in China at the moment. We all know that they've got issues with our government for various things. So do you think it's likely that another Chinese broadcaster would take the deal up, or do you think they would keep their heads down and not potentially annoy the government?
Well, I think this certainly would require local approval. As you correctly said, the relationships between Chinese private companies and the Chinese government doesn't tend to be necessarily as arm's length as it is here in the UK. And that's not a good thing or a bad thing. That's just a thing. It's just a cultural difference. There is huge interest in China in the Premier League. So if it's not being shown on the traditional channels, I think people won't be happy. One of our regular question writers, Nigel in Hong Kong, he's been in contact, and he was saying that he felt that there would be unhappiness if they didn't get the opportunity to see the Premier League in China. And I think from the Premier League's point of view, it's a huge market. You've got clubs such as Manchester United who have got theme parks. It's just been set up in China.
Yeah.
There's been a lot of tours there in order to build up interest and merchandise sales and things of that nature. So I think it's in the interest of the club, certainly the Premier League. And I would imagine the Chinese football fan that this gets resolved in one way or the other.
Well, and also, as you say, there's not only Chinese ownership in the Premier League, Wolves in particular, but there's a lot of Chinese companies sponsoring various parts of the Premier League as well. Do you think clubs that are sponsored by Chinese, mainly gambling companies, have got anything to worry about?
At this stage, no. In terms of the gambling regulations, it's a popular activity in the Far East. So I don't think that they'll be willing to turn that particular tap off.
Right.
But also, if you take a look at perimeter advertising, you know, the number of times you go to a match these days and you see perimeter advertising in Mandarin or Cantonese is quite surprising. But it's indicative of the interest in the game over there.
Right, and you hinted that Wigan was going to be mentioned, and on Thursday we'll be getting an update on the ever-changing saga at the club from Caroline Molyneux, who you may recall was with us a few weeks ago. She's chair of the Wigan Athletic Supporters Club. But in the meantime, one of the potential serious buyers has dropped out.
Well, yeah, this is the splendidly named Norman Smurthwaite, which is about as northern as you could possibly get in for a person's name. Absolute textbook. Now, Norman, he used to be the owner of Port Vale. He originally bought Port Vale, and hold on to this, from the administrators.
Oh, no.
In, I think, about 2012, 2013. I think it's fair to say that his tenure of ownership is best described as controversial. He banned the local paper because he didn't like what they wrote about him. He banned the Port Vale Fans Trust because he didn't like what they were saying about him. And then in order to save costs, and this is ingenious in a way, after matches, the players used to be served with the pies which were unsold from the merchandise stalls.
Nice.
So therefore they were rock hard and cold, yeah. Which probably isn't very good from a sports science perspective, but it did save money. Since acquiring Port Vale, which he did eventually sell, he bought it, I think, for 1.25 million, and he was trying to sell it for a factor of three or four times that amount until it was eventually sold, and relations between owners and fans have improved. He tried to buy Torquay United until it was pointed out to him you can't own two clubs at once, which you think that somebody would have, you know, tested the water on that before getting involved. By all accounts, he was interested in buying Bury. He was interested in buying Notts County when they went into administration. So his approach to football seems to be, you know, buy it cheap and then try to make a bit of money on the back of that. So when it came to Wigan, there was a lot of hostility initially set up by Port Vale fans, and he pulled out. He said it was going to cost him up to £10 million over the next 18 months just in terms of operating losses. He didn't like the fact that the administrators had sold the training ground. He didn't like some of the issues to do with the stadium. So he seemed to be very, very vocal as to that he's a good guy, and he was forced by circumstances to pull out.
Right. I was about to say during that, of course, Robert Maxwell famously wanted to own two clubs at the same time. And then you said testing the water, and I thought it wouldn't be appropriate to do a Robert Maxwell joke in those circumstances. That's a reference for the kids. But I do have a pleasing image of Norman Smurthwaite offering Robbie Williams a stale pie at the end of a Port Vale game as well. So, that's a shame.
I've been abused by Robert Maxwell, by the way. This is one of my footnotes in history.
Yeah.
A company had gone into administration, and I was in charge of the creditors meeting, which meant that as I was the junior on the job, I had to go and check the names of everybody attending the meeting. And this was taking place in Manchester Town Hall. So it was quite a big glamorous job at the time, and high profile stuff. Manchester City Council had a no smoking rule. Robert Maxwell arrived, followed by two of his kids. I think the two sons, not the one that's presently up on a charge in New York. And he was smoking this huge cigar. So I said, "Yeah, what's your name? What company do you represent?" And then I said, "Excuse me, sir. Do you mind that this is a no smoking meeting?" And he just said, "Fuck off," and walked straight past me.
Oh, well, okay. doesn't surprise. I think let's not explain who Robert Maxwell was to some of our younger listeners. I think Google him, I think, is the easiest thing to do while we get onto the questions. And I like the fact you're a public spirited sort of person, Kieran, that you'd point out it's a no smoking meeting to Robert Maxwell. Well done. our first question comes from David Stout. Now, David has been talking to his friend. Have you, David? That's the sort of thing I say when I've got a question I'm not sure about. So yeah, my mate reckons. But David Stout has been talking to his friend about the potential Jadon Sancho move from Dortmund to Manchester United, which is on or off or never happening, according to which tabloid you believe. The figure Dortmund are asking for is supposedly 120 million euros made up of an upfront fee. So David says, say that upfront fee is 80 million. It's also a range of performance-related add-ons as well. So David and his friend want to know how this would all be accounted for. So if it is 80 million and he gets a four-year contract amortized at 20 million a year for the upfront fee, where do the add-ons go in the accounts?
Right. Well, if you go to the small print of Manchester United's accounts, and it will probably come as no surprise that that's what I've done, they've got a note which they refer to as contingent liabilities. And a contingent liability is this is money we might or might not have to pay at some point in the future. And looking as far as United are concerned, that's 74 million quid, which consists of 12 million pounds for international caps, 44 million pounds based on the number of appearances for United or success, and 18 million for other factors, which tends to be things like winning the Ballon d'Or and the Player of the Year award and things of that nature, or perhaps scoring a certain number of goals. So that's what, how you deal with those things. And the way that you account for them is that once the Manchester United board believe that that is probable, i.e. more than a 50-50 chance of taking place, you then add that on to the cost of the transfer, and then you amortize it over the remainder of the remainder of the contract. So it will eventually get amortized if the United board think it's going to take place, but the idea of add-ons does create, you know, problems, of which the most famous I think is probably that of Seth Johnson, who famously played 59 games for Leeds United because Ken Bates wouldn't let him play a 60th game, and you had the owner dictating to the manager who couldn't and could not play. Because under the terms of the sale of Seth Johnson from Derby County to Leeds United, that if he played a 60th game, they'd have to go and pay an extra quarter of a million or half a million pounds in Ken Bates, who's not noted for being generous, simply said no.
Well, Ken Bates and Robert Maxwell in the same pod. Who would have thought that? It's like the 80s. They didn't have pods in the 80s, but if they did, those two names would have been mentioned quite a lot. Again, kids, Google him. The next question, Kieran, is from Lasse Laipola, who I'm guessing is from Finland. So I'm also guessing I've pronounced his name wrongly. I have a very good friend from Finland, hello Mikko, who's absolutely astonished at our inability to pronounce multi-syllable words on first sight. But does tell me that apparently the Finnish for cornflakes is one of the longest words in the world. There you go. Lasse, if you're from Swindon, by the way, not Finland, I do apologise for many reasons. Lasse's question, Lasse reminds us of two recent discussions. One was about Newcastle being divided into more than 20 companies, and one about fit and proper person tests not applying to ownership of the stadium. So he's been putting his thinking cap on and says, so if, for example, Mike Ashley wanted to sell his club to a new owner who would not pass the fit and proper person test, could he still sell or parcel up the majority of the operations packed in the different companies and sell those to a person who wouldn't pass the fit and proper person test?
I think this is fascinating, and this is if Mike Ashley is listening, I think his ears might have just pricked up. So conceivably this could work. You could divide the club into a series of sets of assets and sell them off one by one, so that the football club itself, which is effectively what is assessed under the owners and directors test, could go to one set of individuals who, you know, are like me and you, Kevin, you know, happy, smiley, no, well, If they delve into my family, they might find a few wrong ones. But, you know, other than that, on the face of it, we're the good guys.
Uh-huh.
And then the other assets, such as the stadium, the training ground, and other facilities, could go to the ne'er-do-wells, or ne'er-do-wells even, who elsewhere. So certainly the owners and directors test does not apply to the landlords, because remember, we've got different people owning Coventry City Football Ground. Yeah. We've got the West Ham situation, where the stadium is owned by the local council, and they are not assessed under owners and directors. So this could be extended much further in theory. So I think Lass has actually come across a cunning plan.
Oh, so we might have to refer to this as Lass's loophole.
Yes,
although, yeah, probably. But no, actually, that sounds a bit. That does sound a bit viz, doesn't it?
give me an idea.
Yes, I knew. I can't see you, but I can visualise exactly what the look on your face is like at the moment. The Baroness is going to, as soon as this pod finishes. Anyway, let's move on. Thomas Taylor. Thomas Taylor wants to know about a company which has based itself around football through the use of the stock market, Football Index, which is growing quickly. But Thomas basically wants to know what you think about it, Kieran, and why doesn't the Premier League make money from fantasy football?
Well, I mean, there's two questions here. So as far as Football Index is concerned, it's a slightly different form of gambling. Instead of gambling on who's going to win a match, who's going to score goals and so on, this is linked to Optostats.
Right.
So, you know, how many yards did a player run, and how many tackles did they make, how many throw-ins did they win, how many aerial duels, so on and so forth. It's mainly focusing on players. What do I think of it? Well, what I think of it is what I think of all gambling, is that you don't see poor gambling companies. So the odds are heavily stacked in favour of the house. Yeah. By all accounts, this Football Index, which I think is Jersey-based, takes a 2% commission, and it pays out dividends to the people that get involved. I mean, you know, if you like to gamble, this is an alternative way of indulging that particular pastime, hobby, however you wish to describe it. Is it better or worse than the others? I don't gamble because I do statistical analysis, and therefore I'm not hugely in favour, especially without, again, going into details. I've got families and friends who have been on the wrong side of gambling, and
of course,
that's not good to see.
Of course.
As far as the fantasy football is concerned, the Premier League do make money out of it, because they effectively sell centrally the rights to use club logos and things of that nature to the fantasy football companies. So it does generate some money for the Premier League.
Okay. I didn't know that. That's interesting. Mark Ridley makes an interesting point. Mark Ridley points out many non-league clubs in England and quite a few league clubs in Scotland have artificial pitches, which Mark quite rightly points out have improved considerably since the 80s, when they were basically green concrete. They cost about £500,000 to install and they require upkeep, of course, but do they provide sufficient income to justify their cost? And why does a club like Harrogate have to dig them up when they get promoted, when they are really a community asset?
Right. Well, if we start off with the Harrogate issue, if you go into the EFL rulebook, which that's how I spent my morning, and rule 15.1, close to both our hearts, of course, and it's just unequivocal. You are not allowed to use artificial pitches, and for that rule to be changed would require a vote by EFL owners, and clearly somebody would have to put that forward.
Yes.
For the vote to begin with.
Any explanation as to why that, Kieran, they don't? I mean, I know they were, I mean, I was totally against them back in the day. The QPR one was a disgrace, the Luton one was terrible, it wasn't proper football, but I mean, yeah, as Mark points out, they're very good services now, so I wonder if they've got an explanation as to why they're so against them.
Well, I mean, they have now been approved by FIFA.
Oh, okay.
If you take a look at the SPFL, a quarter of the teams in the SPFL use them, Livingston, Hamilton Accies and Kilmarnock. Yeah. But the other nine clubs in the SPFL are totally opposed to them. And also there was a poll taken by the SPFA, the Scottish Professional Footballers Association, and their members were opposed to them as well. So I think there's still a lot of suspicion that whilst improvements have been made, they're against them. I think that they're used in the Scottish Championship, Falkirk, and QOTS. Oh, that's not Queen's Queen of the
South. Queen of the South, yeah.
Queen of the South, yeah, I think it's Queen of the Stone Age.
No, Queen of the South. Okay. We would know if there was a club called Queen of the Stone Age in the Scottish football. It's
yes.
Queen of the South. Yeah. They're based in Dumfries.
Oh, right. You see, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
But what we are seeing increasingly is hybrid pitches. So, you know, Wembley, Anfield, many of them where it's a combination. I think it's called Mastergrass or some other system where they've got a lot of polypropylene. You know, you and I both grew up in the 70s and 80s when, you know, by January, teams were playing on rolled mud.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
So, you know, there have been huge improvements in the quality of pitches since then. In terms of the issues, in terms of community assets, I mean, Harrogate broke even in 2019. So the money through the increased utilization of the pitch, and you know, we've used this phrase, which isn't a nice phrase, sweating the assets, making greater use of the ground, does arise as a result of Harrogate's initiative. But they knew when they applied to the EFL that they'd have to rip up the pitch. There's no indication of support from other clubs. Right. And it's a case of persuading owners, managers and players to buy into artificial pitches that I think is going to be the challenge.
Yeah, I think Ali and the Baroness would probably like us to point out that we got older in the 70s and 80s. We didn't necessarily grow up. It's interesting, though. Sutton... Last season, Sutton were doing, what was it, season before? But Sutton were doing really well, very local to me, were doing very well and looked like promotion to the league was very possible. And I happened to be doing some filming there and got chatting to one of the directors who said they weren't anxious about promotion, they were desperate for it, but also said it would actually really negatively impact their finances because the pitch was used every single day by schools or by people who are hiring it. So it Mark's point that it's a community asset is an interesting one. It's interesting as well that the year for you don't get a couple of years to rip it up. You have to rip the pitch up straight away before you can start playing football. This is why they'll be sharing with Doncaster, I believe, weren't they, initially Harrogate. So there's no leeway. It's as simple as that. As soon as you get promoted, that plastic pitch goes.
Yep, yeah, it's unequivocal, the stance taken by the EFL. Rule 15.1, unlike some of the stuff in the EFL handbook, is one sentence, it's one line, and that's it. You do not play on artificial pitches, full stop.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Well, talking of one sentence, Ryan Loftus starts his question by saying, just a quick question. We've been doing this long enough to know, Kieran, that quite often that turns into an essay, but it is a quick question. Ryan Loftus has a quick question about championship prize money. He says, we all know that each position in the Premier League is worth a couple of extra million, but what difference does it make in what he describes as England's true Premier Division? There speaks a fan of a championship club. Hang on, there's a PS. I'm asking as a fan of Millwall, I told you, who could have finished anywhere between 10th and 5th last season, between 20th and 5th, I think you'll find, Ryan. But it's a quick question. Is there a quick answer?
It is. As Morrissey once said, what difference does it make? It makes none. There is no such thing as prize money in the championship. The only benefits is that if you get to the playoffs, you get an extra home fixture, but that's about as far as it goes. So, you know, even when we were looking at Derby a couple of weeks ago, and they could have had a potential points deduction if that had dropped them from, I think, 8th or 9th where they finished to 14th or 15th, it would not have hit them financially at all. It's only in the Premier League where, in a non-COVID world, it's now worth around about £2.7 million per position. So, you know, for there, 5th and 10th is, you know, £13 million. But in the Championship, it's just the honour of finish 10th or 5th.
Oh, wow, okay. Mark Tuckett has got, I like this, Greg. This is a proper football fan question. This is a proper what if Eeyore type question. Mark said, which is why I like it so much. Mark says, given the current pandemic and its impact on football, is it more financially beneficial for Leeds United to have missed out on promotion last season and been promoted this, or would it have been better if they got promoted last season and then went straight back down like Norwich?
It would make far better for them to have been promoted at the end of last season. And the reason for that is that if Leeds had had another season in the Championship, they would have been the club to have potentially lost the most in terms of matchday income, because their matchday was over £18 million in 2018-19. Which is a testament to the fact that they were selling out every week. And if you go to if you rock up at Elland Road as an away fan, it was 45 notes the last time I went.
Yeah.
So you know, it's expensive to watch football there on a match by match basis. I think season tickets are far more reasonable. So they would have potentially had to have the whole of this season without that match day income, which is a big contributor to their overall budget. The manager, my understanding, is the best paid manager in the Championship. He's on around about £3.5 million a year. And I suspect he wouldn't have stayed either because out of his own choice or because the club would have had to have had cutbacks. Yeah, they probably lost £20 million last season. They lost £20 million the previous season. Therefore, under those circumstances, they would have been looking at squeaky bum time from an FFP scenario.
Right.
So you know, I think they'd have little choice but to cut back on expenditure.
Do you know, I like you, Kieran, I can't. I'm just hoping and praying for the day when we can all get back to football, when the stadiums are sold out on match day. But I really hope it happens in time for the first Man United Leeds game, because that's a proper fixture, isn't it?
I've been to Old Trafford to watch Manchester United Leeds, when I was at university. So that had been, what, 80, 81?
Oh, yeah.
And a League Cup game. Leeds scored after 4 minutes. Peter Barnes was playing for them at the time. And it was World War. Absolutely crazy stuff.
Kids, add Peter Barnes to your list of people to Google. There's Ken Bates, Peter Barnes. Who are these people going on about? Underrated player, I thought, Peter Barnes. Anyway, Luke Murphy. Now, Luke, I like Luke, because Luke, like me, seems to see football finance mainly through the medium of kits, basically. And Luke's question is, do clubs pay the manufacturer or the sponsor for all the kits and training gear they use throughout the season, or does that all come free as part of the deal? And there's a follow-up question from Ian McLaughlin. I pronounce that name with some certainty because that was my mother's maiden name. But Ian McLaughlin has been listening since day one and loves Kieran's tales of spreadsheets and debauchery. There's the title of your autobiography, isn't it? You'd buy that book in Waterstones, wouldn't you? This looks interesting. Spreadsheets and debauchery. Okay. But Ian's another Leeds fan, and he wants to know whether the long-rumoured new deal with Adidas, which has finally happened, replacing Kappa as kit manufacturer, will make a difference to Leeds financially.
Right. Well, let's take a look at those questions in turn. First of all, Luke's question. It will depend upon the club. If you are a League One or League Two club, you will be given X sets of kit as part of the deal from the manufacturer. Right. So it could be that you're given 6 sets of home kits, 6 sets of away kits, and anything in excess of that, you will pay more for. When it comes to the bigger clubs, when you've got the likes of Adidas paying Manchester United £75 million a year, they tend to be, you know, if you want some more kit, they'll just send a batch over, because the marginal cost to them, you know, because they only cost 5 or 10 or each to produce. Is that a siren I can hear in the background?
Yes, it is. I'm tempted to do the brilliant Eric Morecambe joke. He's not going to sell much ice cream going at that speed, but we're already stuck in the 80s. Let's not go back to the 70s. But yes, it is a siren, Kieran. You're getting nostalgic for South London now, are you?
I am indeed. Yes, such a contrast that yesterday, as it was the start of the football season, and I said to the Baroness, oh, well, you know, it's who was it? It was Walsall versus Sheffield Wednesday. Uh-huh. And she says, you're not doing that. And she dragged me out. We live about 500 yards away from a vinery, whatever wherever they make wine. I know nothing about alcohol.
So we went on a vineyard.
Yes.
Vinery is fine. Vineyard is what we tend to call it.
Vineyard sounds like, yes. So I was taken on my first ever vineyard tour. Which was perhaps slightly wasted on me. But then they sat us down afterwards, and they brought two glasses of each of the wines that they make, mm-hmm. of which, of course, I consumed precisely zero. Mm-hmm. And I had to give the Baroness a piggyback home from Beacon Down, the local vineyard. But she said it was very good. And to get my revenge this morning, I dragged her out to the beach at 7 o'clock in the morning to walk the dog.
Your life couldn't be more different to my life, Kieran. You know that. Just remind me what football team again you support as we talk about your tour of the vineyard.
Brighton Hove Albion.
Yeah, there you go. I rest my case. Okay. Right. So higher up the league. How did we get talking about? Oh yes, police cars. Higher up the league, then. So clubs get as many free kicks as they want, basically. Right.
Yeah. And also because the club will be always getting requests for signed shirts and things of this nature. What they don't particularly want is that, you know, if the club's giving out some shirts to a local charity, if the club turns round to the charity and says, well, you know, Adidas have said we've got to go and charge you 50 quid for each shirt.
Yeah.
That, you know, from a public relations point of view, it doesn't look too clever. So, you know, Adidas and Nike for the big boys, they're going to be pretty chilled about it within reason. When it comes to the Leeds kit and the deal with Adidas, I mean, Leeds have had practically every kit manufacturer. They've had Nike and Macron and Kappa and God knows who else, but now they're back with Adidas. They will get a fixed fee from Adidas. We don't know how much, but they also get a commission in each sale. I think the advantage to Leeds is that, you know, we know that Leeds is a big city club, but it also has a fairly decent international following. The very fact that Leeds played Manchester United in Australia in a friendly last summer is indicative of they've got international appeal, is that Adidas have lots of retail outlets dotted around the world. And that will help to increase the volume of sales, on which, of course, the club's getting it's normally about a 7% commission on shirts.
Leeds are a huge club, so Adidas won't have been waiting for them to get into the Premier League before they slipped in with this deal, will they?
No, the deal was actually signed in January.
Ah, okay.
And we were talking about contingent payments earlier on. It was X million and then X million times two or three for each season that Leeds are in the Premier League. So, from a commercial point of view, again, going back to Mark Tuckett's question earlier, the club is far better off going up this season.
Now, our next question comes from another Luke. This is Luke Hatherley with another interesting proposal, actually. So we've already got Lasse's loophole. We could have Luke's loophole. Is that better? No. Luke starts by saying he loves the pod, especially the comedy from Kevin. I imagine Guy was over the moon when he finally got a question that mentioned me rather than you. So this is definitely in. Guy would have been going, this is in. Hang on, we've got a million listeners. I'm off. Luke loves the pod. This is a really interesting suggestion, I think. Luke says, what happens to all the money when clubs or players are fined by the league, either for misbehaviour or FFP infractions, etc.? Why not, says Luke, put all that money into a pot that is then shared out to all the other clubs at the end of the season? It might prevent clubs breaking FFP rules or keeping their players under control if they think that money is going into their competitors' pockets. Is that a good concept?
It is a good concept. And indeed, when the EFL first introduced FFP, this was one of the proposals And my understanding, and I might have got this wrong, was that it was subject to a potential legal challenge from a club that looked at it as if it might be subject to fines, because before they've only introduced points deductions in the last, I think, since 2016. Mm. So as a consequence of that, the FFP fines, in theory, should be going to charity. As far as the Football Association is concerned, I delved into their accounts when researching this one, and they do have a heading in the accounts called Other Income. And I think they generated around about £10 million from fines and things of a similar nature. Now, in theory, I think that goes because the FA are not club orientated. They could spend that anywhere. But it looks as if that goes for under the umbrella heading of good of the game. So it will be going out in grants and support networks and things of that nature.
No, okay. Now, our final question, Kieran, comes from Will Jennings. And Will's question crystallises quite a few of the areas we've been talking about recently around fan ownership and other models. Will talks about Scottish Lowland League side Caledonian Braves, who have started an app which allows you for £20 to help make decisions relating to the club, as well as accessing footage of games and all the usual stuff you'd get from a club app. And Will says, at a time when the culture sector is rapidly considering all kinds of new ideas to stay afloat, tell me about it, are other football clubs considering alternative ownership management structures to ensure their survival? Although Will does remind us that you might remember that Ebbsfleet Town had a similar scheme which suffered huge dropout after year one when everyone got bored of it. But basically, Will simply asks, will clubs in this country ever move away from the essentially rich benefactor supported by a gambling company sponsor as a model? Is that the only model that British football can sustain?
It depends where you set your ceiling in respect of this. If you have a club which is being funded directly or quasi-directly by fans, and this proposal of Will's, or sorry, the Caledonian team, it certainly has some merits. I think it will provoke some interest, but is it a novelty as much as a management decision? Management by committee genuinely doesn't tend to work the bigger the committee gets. There's an ideal size for a committee, and it should never really be more than seven, according to academic research done by universities and things of this nature. So when you've got hundreds or potentially thousands of people, the more people that get involved, the less they feel involved.
So there's a
danger that they then go and I think the technical term is see their arse when their ideas don't go through. So looking at the Caledonian proposals, one of which is I think something to do with the club crest, choosing the colour of the kits in future seasons and this nature, all of which very, very laudable. But there does tend to be quite a high churn rate. And it can also lead to factionalisation when you have some more on the face of it seem to be democratic ownership models. I mean, I live in Manchester for most of my life. FC United of Manchester was sort of a semi-brainchild of one of my colleagues when I was at university in Manchester lecturing. And that worked really well. I mean, you know, FC United was a fantastic experience.
Yeah.
But that club ended up having civil war and it got really nasty when different groups of people decided that their vision for the future was the one. And, you know, the club sort of suffered both on and off the pitch, sort of had a hiatus for all the progress they were making as a result of that.
I'll just point out, Kieran, that see their arse seems to be your technical term for a lot of things. It covers a lot of bases, that expression, during this pod. I think it's interesting that Will talks about the Ebbsfleet Town experiment, which is a few years ago, which quite a few fans seem to think was like a real-life championship manager. People who didn't have any affiliation to Ebbsfleet Town at all became part of this scheme because they thought they would actually influence all sorts of things, non-playing as well as playing. And as Will says, it fell away very shortly. I mean, is it pessimistic to think that we're so ingrained in the rich owner model in this company that we really never will be able to look beyond proper fan ownership, except at a level like Clapton, which we had a massive response when we had people from Clapton talking about their club. That level, it is possible, but beyond that, there's only one way you can run a football club in this country, and that's find somebody who can afford it.
I'm not necessarily certain. Remember, Wickham were in League One before they went into private ownership a few months ago. We do have clubs such as Motherwell in Scotland, which have been successful. I think you have to set out the club's objectives. If you want to succeed in football beyond a certain level, the chances are that the clubs are going to lose money, or they're going to be operating at a budget such that they effectively have their own ceiling in the sense that they can't compete for players and managers and facilities against some of the other clubs in the division. So unless they've got a fantastic rapport in the dressing room and they happen to strike it lucky with a couple of apprentices or loanees, then it's going to be a real challenge. So it's down to the club itself. If you are perfectly happy being at your present level as a community club, then for heaven's sake, keep it up, because A, you're doing something great for your locality. You are giving identity to your town or city. And you're also having a good time.
Yeah. Wickham fans looked for private ownership precisely because of that. They thought they could no longer generate enough income to support or compete at that level, which is slightly ironic because then they've just got promoted to the Championship. So,
yeah. Yeah, but they were in genuine danger of going into administration pre-pandemic. So when the new owner came in, who's an American lawyer, and I had few conversations with people from Wickham during those during the time when he was making a pitch. I think there were concerns about. You've been to Adams Park. I've been to Adams Park. It's a very valuable piece of real estate. And I think that was part of the concerns. Would the club be moved off to an out of town site? Could this be another example of what we've seen at Coventry? What we've seen, what we saw at Brighton? Yeah, we got kicked out, and our ground was sold for property developers, and it takes a long time to get back to an even keel.
Yeah, you were away for 8 years. Was it in the end?
Well, it was 2 years at Gillingham, and then we were playing an athletics track, for about 8 or 9 years. So yeah, it wasn't fun watching it, or it was very green.
Yeah, I realised, I was trying to feign interest in Brighton, but failed miserably. Basically, Will, thank you for that. It's a really interesting question, and I wanted to ask it because it sort of draws a line under a conversation that we've been having quite a lot recently about fan ownership. So I think we've covered all those bases now, but that's an interesting point. Thank you to everybody who's asked a question. Thank you if you're one of the million people who's downloaded our pod once, or one of the 100,000 people who's downloaded it 10 times. I'm not sure how it works. But thank you all. We appreciate your listenership very much. We'll be back on Thursday, and I'll hand you over to Kieran for the closing speech.
Well, first of all, thanks again from us. I think we are genuinely chuffed at hitting this particular number.
Yes, we are.
because we got very giddy when we first got to 10,000, which was after about 10 shows. That was cause for celebrations. It's not up with Kevin's BAFTA award, of course.
Nomination, Kieran. I did win the Writers' Award, but that's fine. BAFTA is just a nomination, Kieran.
BAFTA is the fact that your name is on a BAFTA certificate is hats off, as far as I'm concerned.
You've seen it. It's on my wall. It's very prominent.
I have seen it. I have seen it. Every time I go into your house, you're busy pointing at it as we walk past.
Yeah, and I'm starting to wonder how long. It was 2016. I'm starting to wonder how long it'll be before it seems sad to have something from 2016 hanging on your wall. But, I could have a Van Gogh. That's from 18, whatever. Never mind. Carry on.
So if you enjoy the show, if you like the show, if you could give that big purple thing in front of you a bash, it's that Apple icon, the Apple podcast app icon. Give us a review, subscribe as well. We don't understand how it works, myself and Kevin. We are genuine Luddites on the technology side of things. But producer guy says it's good for business. We're still awaiting delivery of our cars. Hopefully, we'll also be getting delivery of some Beacon Down wine. From the Vineyard Tour as well.
We'll have to wrestle it off the Baroness first, I'm guessing.
Yes, she's very protective of her rosé, fizz, whatever that is. Yeah. And if you could give us a review, it makes a difference to the Apple algorithm. But apart from that, our big thanks as always, and stay safe.
Yeah, I can't tell you, Kieran, you'll have to stay safe again. That's always the last words. But I just wanted to say, I can't tell you how unimpressed Ali was last week when she asked me what I was chuckling at. And I said, I was chuckling at you saying, bashing the big purple thing. our sense of humour doesn't always cross. So those two final words again, please, Kieran.
Stay safe. The price of football. Price of football.